Any burning questions before I launch into something that's of interest to me? Okay.
When are we going to tell us how our refrigerator works?
How what?
Our refrigerator works.
Oh. As I mentioned before, not until we talk about thermodynamics. Maybe we'll start on that today. Brother back there?
Can you tell us why I don't get any money from your diamonds?
Well, how do you know I don't? Indirectly. No, when you go to work when you go to work for a large company, at least in past ages, certainly 28 years ago when I went to work for a large company, you were their property. You signed a contract. Anything you discovered was theirs. And that's the way it used to be. It still is, but somewhat more liberal nowadays. In fact, occasionally a scientist has sued a company when he's done something fairly big and managed to get in on it more. Friends have urged me to do that years ago, but I never thought I could stand the hassle of trying to sue a company. I never ventured out of that. Now, there are some companies that give royalties on what you do for them. DuPont is such a company. But still, in the main, most companies don't. They pay a pretty good salary, as a rule. And that takes care of it. It's a statistical thing with a company, that is, research is. It's like insurance. General Electric Company had about 1,000 scientists in Schenectady, New York, at their main research lab. Well, during the lifetime of those guys working for GE, only 10% of them will ever do anything that will make money for the company. So, as I say, it's a statistical thing. They hire a great number of guys hoping somebody will pull something off. So if you're lucky enough to pull something off, then you have a good feeling the rest of your life that you've managed to provide the salary for 9 other scientists for their lifetime. But that's the way it is. I could have continued to make real good money at General Electric. In fact, I guess it wouldn't hurt to tell you these kind of numbers. I went to work for General Electric for $6,200 a year in 1948, which was a good salary. I found out my friends from MIT, Yale, Harvard, and whatnot were only getting $5,700. I was the fourth person to graduate with a PhD from the University of Utah, podunk school sort of in those days. Yet the company paid me more than... I was worried about not being able to compete, but I could compete. There was no problem. My training was good. I think the same is true today. A guy who gets a degree in chemistry at BYU can be on par with anybody anywhere. Going to Berkeley and whatnot gives you the name. But your training may not even be as good because you don't get as much personal attention there as you get here. Well, now, at the time I made diamonds, my salary had gone up to, I don't know, somewhere around 12,000, maybe 13. But I was aware that there was one guy there who was making 18, and he really wasn't doing very much. And on making diamonds, a raise was forthcoming, but I didn't think it was big enough. In fact, the raise was from some lower number, which was maybe 9 or 10 up to something like 12. And in my own mind, I thought that was kind of chintzy. You have to understand my personality. I'm a lot more aggressive now than when I was younger. I was rather introverted and not one to complain or afraid of bosses and whatnot to be pushy or ask for what I deserved. As a rule. But I just decided in my own mind, if they don't give me a big enough raise, maybe I'll do something else. And I didn't think they'd give me a big enough raise. And so I looked around a little bit for other jobs and had quite a number of offers. But in the meantime, this diamond publicity, which appeared as front page news on 95% of America's newspapers. And by the way, the advertising boys at General Electric figured that front page news was worth about $1.5 million, free advertising, and the Diamond Project had only run up about $300,000 bill. So they figured it was paid for right off just with all that advertising. And General Electric stock went up too. Guys in the lab knew that the stock would go up at the announcement, about $5 a share, which was real good back in those days. But nobody, we were all young, struggling kids coming along and whatnot, you know. No money to invest. But there was one bachelor in the lab who had $20,000. And he sucked the whole works in GE stock the day before. He made $5 on every share.
How much did a share cost?
Well, back in those days, I think the stock was maybe only $20 a share. Mm-hmm. And it's been split three or four times since then, and I think now it runs around $65. The president, the big wheels in the company were smart enough to invest too, and the newspaper men really prodded them. Well, you knew this was coming off, you knew it would make GE stock go up, did you invest? And they always had the question, they'd say, well, nobody invests in General Electric for stock for speculative purposes. Just blue chip stock is an investment, you know. They all hedge the question, but I'm sure they were smart enough to put money in. I would have done the same if I'd have had any. Well, all that publicity caught the eye of Ernest Wilkinson out here, who was busy trying to build a school. Harvey Fletcher had two jobs. He was director of research for the university, and also he was dean of the College of Physical Engineering Science. This is the older Dr. Fletcher, who's almost 90 years old now, maybe you've seen him around, a very famous man. And they saw my name in the paper, and I guess the word got around, I was Latter-day Saint, so Ernie Wilkinson called me on the phone and wanted to know if I would take a job out of here. And they said, it's conference time, come on out, we'll pay your way. And just look it over. Well, the thought of working at BYU had never entered my mind in my life. In fact, I'd only been in Provo once in my life, passing through on a train to Denver. And I have to take that back. I came to an ACS meeting down here once. So I think twice is a true statement that I've been in Provo. Well, I came out, and this campus was just so beautiful. The sky was blue, and clouds like some April days can be, and I just decide, well, no matter what they pay me, I'll come. Well, when the GE people found that I was interested in another job, they quickly really upped the offer for me to stay. They offered me $20,000 a year to stay, which in 1955 was real good money, and that would have put me above that guy I knew was making 18. But I came out here for $7,500 a year. I never knew how I was going to make it, faith or something, I guess. But the bosses, they really got on me back at GE. They said, how much are they going to pay you? My word, you know, we've offered you 20. And I hummed and hawed, and I just wouldn't tell them, you know. They want to know how much they're going to pay me. They figured that must be the incentive. And I told them, no, I couldn't tell them how much you're going to pay. I says, they're not going to pay me what you're paying here, but I figure I'll make it up in consulting. And they all laughed. They says, Hall, you're too young to consult. I was 35 at the time. They says, you got to be 45 and have still more experience and whatnot. But they were wrong, because right off, guys start coming after me for being consultants. Now, consultants make pretty good pay. We're never going to get around any chemistry day. You got me going. Well, let me tell you about this, because it's kind of an interesting story. The most famous man in high pressure in the world back in those days was Percy W. Bridgman. Did I ever mention his name to you? He was a professor at Harvard University. Old world type professor. The European professors are really the professor. Their contact with students is nil, and they're formal as the dickens. And I guess back in the good old days, they probably still do it in some European universities. The guy would wear his academic robes, and he marches into the classroom, and he reads his lecture usually, never looking at a student, and then he walks out. No questions, no answers, no nothing. Well, he was of that old-time formal Professor Tide's school. He began his work in high pressure in 1905 at Harvard University, and had a, you see, it's only modern times where universities have had large sums of money from government and other people for research. But for his period in historical time, universities, he had all kinds of money for research, much more than the average professor. And he had that money for a period of approximately 40 years. And he worked in the field of high pressure, and he was interested in making diamonds all that time. He never succeeded, but he did many good things. He achieved pressures of 100,000 atmospheres, but in very tiny volumes. His volume was as thin as a sheet of paper, and just a little tiny circle of paper, smaller than, if you take a punch, you know, and punch out the disc, that was the shape and size of his sample. And he managed to subject such a tiny little bit of stuff to 100,000 atmospheres. Now, with this belt that I invented at Geoelectric, I got up to what I thought in that day was 200,000 atmospheres. But we now know it was only 140,000 atmospheres. But you see, that was beyond Bridgman. Bridgman never learned how to heat his sample at the same time. And that was the problem. That's the problem that I had success in. I was able to put the pressure in and the temperature in simultaneously. And I was able to do it in a large volume, because the volume of my sample was 10,000 times as large as Bridgman's. My sample was 1 inch long, about 3/16 of an inch in diameter, and I could have that at about 3,000 degrees centigrade and 140,000 atmospheres. Well, this Bridgman published about 145 papers during his lifetime in the field of high pressure. He only had two graduate students in all that time. He had a machinist who worked for him full time, and a guy called a reader, who was in essence his permanent graduate student, and then Bridgman. And they said Bridgman was so formal that Charlie Chase, who was the machinist, and they say at Harvard University there was only one machinist that was better than Charlie Chase, and that was Percy Bridgman. So he was a theoretician, more of a physicist than a chemist. In fact, he was a physicist. He had a disdain for chemists. He was a physicist. But he was a good mechanic, good machinist, you know, all that end of things, in addition to being a good physicist, both theoretical and practical. But they say that his reader, as he called him, would set up the experiments. Bridgman would have a discussion with him, tell him what he wanted to do, make some sketches for Charlie Chase, and they'd get the experiment set up. And when everything was ready to go, then Bridgman would actually come in and take the readings, not the guy called his reader. But they say Bridgman would walk in and he'd have his long tails on, and the man would pull out the chair for him, and Bridgman would sit down and flip his tails back so he wouldn't be sitting on them, you know. Then Bridgman would take the readings on whatever he was doing on the experiment. Well, he received the Nobel Prize in 1948 for his work in the field of high pressure. Now, when diamonds were made at Geoelectric did not want to tell the world how they had done it. They wanted to keep it a secret, because what I had done was a commercial thing. They'd have been satisfied just with a scientific thing, but it turned out to be commercial. 2.5 years after I first made diamonds, Geoelectric was busy selling them. They grew rapidly, and in large quantity, relatively speaking. A scientist in high position scolded Chauncey Suits, who was the director of research at General Electric Company, and told him this was awful. Guys have been trying to make diamonds for 150 years here. They're made at General Electric, and you tell us that you did it, but you don't tell us how you did it. And so to try and find a way out of this, somebody in the company, I suppose Chauncey Suits himself, decided that they'd hire Percy Bridgman, have him come and see if he didn't want to see how diamonds were made. They figured he would, because he'd been trying his whole life to do it. And then have him write an article in a scientific journal, a popular scientific journal like Scientific American. And then hear this Nobel Prize high pressure man, see what sort of verify and make it more palatable to the world and the scientific community, and yet Geoelectric still would not have to disclose what they had done. They contacted Bridgman and found out that he was a consultant for the DuPont company. Now, most of the time, a guy does not consult for two companies at the same time. I have, and maybe I'll get around to telling you that part of the story too. But Bridgman said, well, maybe DuPont would let him out of his contract because, yeah, he'd like to come. And so he talked to DuPont, and DuPont let him out of his contract, and then he became a consultant for General Electric. Now, diamonds had already been made. The belt apparatus is made. The whole thing was done. But Bridgman was now a high-pressure consultant for General Electric after everything was over. Now, they brought Bridgman down to my lab, and we were introduced, and I was anxious to meet him. I thought he'd be a really interesting character. And I showed him how to make the diamond, showed him the belt apparatus and whatnot. And, of course, with his background, and, of course, what he had done, you always stand on the shoulders of what men have done before, and I knew all his work, and in a sense had taken off from some of his ideas and gone farther. And he just paced around my lab with his hands behind his back, shaking his head like this. And he was obviously, to me at least, a very disappointed man. Here it was so obvious and so easy, you know, to have made diamond. And he'd worked 40 years, had all kinds of money compared to the average researcher who tried to do it and had not succeeded. At one point, he had $100,000 given to him in 1937 to work on that problem. 1937, $100, $100,000 was like having $1 million today. Well, he was awfully quiet. Now, I tended to be real introverted in those days, and it was hard for me to carry on a conversation with people. But I could get zero conversation out of him. I'd ask him questions about his life and about this, that, and the other, and it's always a short answer, yes or no answer. Just no conversation. Well, I got tired of that after a while, and so I just went back to sitting down at a desk where I was working, and there was a desk just back to me, and he's sitting down there contemplating something or other. The boss walked in and saw that. And he got hold of me, he says, I want to see you. He hustled me out there. He says, hey, he says, we're paying this guy all kinds of money here to be a consultant. He says, you're supposed to be picking his brain, learning everything you can. Well, I sputtered and tried to explain. I couldn't talk to him. Yeah, hustled him off to talk to some other guys. Well, that was my main contact with Bridgman, except for a party that was held for him when we first hired him, and I was disappointed that the man drank whiskey with the rest of the guys. I think for some reason I have Bridgman pictured on a pedestal where he wouldn't do anything like that. He didn't smoke, but he drank the cocktails and whatnot all along with the rest of the guys. This party we had for him. Well, now I have to go back. There are a couple of things I left out. Oh, as to jobs here, they offered me my... Harry Fletcher didn't care which job he had. I think he did. I think he preferred the director of research job, but he told me I could have my choice. Either job I want, dean of the college or director of research. And I says, oh, I'd much rather have the director of research. I didn't like the idea of all that administrative work attached with the other kind of business. So I became the university's director of research, a position I held here for 12 years. I was tired of it after 5 years, so I didn't like the administrative work there either. But they wouldn't let me off the hook. It took me a long time to persuade them to release me from that position. But when they did, they made me a distinguished professor, which was a good thing, I guess, because there are only a couple on campus. I think there have been four or five all told, but right now I think there are only a couple on campus. Well, now back to this consulting business story. Well, I hadn't been out here very long before General Electric people came after me to see if I would be a consultant for them. Well, I wanted to be pretty cagey about that. I probably could have played it smarter than I did, but I went back to Detroit, and that's where the diamond-making plant had been placed. And we talked about all kinds of things, and I had lots of suggestions as to how they could improve the belt apparatus for commercial use and whatnot. And they drew up a kind of a informal contract, which seemed to be kind of acceptable. Some things I didn't like, but I thought maybe I could live with it. And then near the end of the day, of course, then the final thing you have to do is getting around to talking about, well, how much money are we going to pay? And so when it came to that subject, now, I don't know how I ever did this. It was just not completely out of character for me, but they finally came to that point, well, how much money do you want? And just like that, I had given it zero thought, but just like that, it says, how much you paying Bridgman? Their mouths kind of dropped. They didn't expect that kind of a question. You know, we don't disclose such things and whatnot, but I kept pressing. I said, well, you tell them how much you pay for this. They finally says, well, we pay him $250 a day. And like that, I said, I'll take $300. And, boy, then their mouths really did drop. But they says, well, something like that, we'd have to go upstairs and get approval from the vice president. But they weren't up there very long. They came back down and says, we'll pay you $300. Then the contract arrived out here next week, and it wasn't what we'd talked about. And I talked it over with Harvey Fletcher and told him the points I didn't like. And he says, well, it's a lot of money. He says, I never got that kind of consulting money. But he says, if you don't like the contract, I wouldn't do it. So I did. I wrote him a letter, told him that the contract didn't agree with what we talked about, and I wouldn't do it. Well, I didn't end it. They came out periodically. They sent out a vice president to twist my arm. I think it was about 1957. Come back for salary of around $35,000 a year. But that didn't influence me too much because I'd had a half a dozen offers to go other places for around $35,000 a year after I come out here, and I still only make about $7,500. But things picked up around here, and I consulted here and there for my $300 fee at other places. Pretty soon other companies arrived from me, General Motors, U.S. Steel, various governmental agencies and whatnot, and I started to pick up money equal to my BYU salary just in a few days of going off to New York or Washington or someplace. But the final offer that General Electric did give me was, I think, about 1964. They offered me $65,000 a year to go back to work for them, and I turned that down too. Now, I've never made that kind of money, but I've done all right. And so to answer your question, while I never received anything directly, indirectly, because of the fame attached to making diamonds and whatnot, I got paid pretty good. The time I consulted for two companies at once, the U.S. Steel came after me to consult for them at their fundamental lab back in Pittsburgh one time. And they offered me, General Motors, I guess, was paying me about $350 a day. They offered me $450 a day. And so I told the General Motors people, I'd already consulted for General Motors about all the good I thought I could do them on improving their Vega. Not, it wasn't the Vega. What was that crummy one they finally did away with? The rear engine drive thing? Corvair. Anyway, I didn't think I was doing much good, and I just didn't go try another place. So I told them that the U.S. Steel
wanted me as a consultant, and I'd like to resign from theirs, and I really wasn't doing them all that much good. And they says, well, how come you're trading over? So they says, is more money involved? And I said, no, one thing. And they says, well, how much more are they gonna pay you? And I says, $450. And he says, well, that's no problem. Well, I says, well, how about a conflict of interest? No, that's no problem. So I stayed on at $450 a day for them, went up to $450 for them, and I got $450 from U.S. Steel. So that's a pretty good year. I have made more, and I have turned down more. I did consult for General Electric later on in a way. I served as expert witness in a court case in South Africa for which GE paid me $2,000 a day for 14 days. How do you like that? And I had a better deal offered. The last time General Electric wanted me was about 3 or 4 years ago, patent litigation again, where an expert witness, if he's in the right position, can get darn near anything he wanted. They offered me $6,000 a day to go to Japan, and I turned it down. The reason I turned it down is by then we had our own diamond business going out here, and I just felt it was a conflict of interest. So I didn't go on that one. But I don't like consulting anymore. In spite of the high wages it pays, I made as much money as I need to live reasonably well. I'm not rich, but I live okay, and I don't like to consult, so I gave it up several years back.
Tell us how you made diamonds.
Didn't I ever tell you that?
You never told us how you really came about
doing it. I thought I did, didn't I?
No, you never.
You were going to tell us about your company, too.
I didn't tell you how I come to make diamonds.
You said you were going to wait for a little
work. Tell us how you did it,
Well, I gave you the story, didn't I, and how I saw him on that day and all that sort of stuff.
No, nothing.
I didn't. That's a problem. If I go back and review my tapes, I guess I'd know what I've told you and what I haven't, but I'm not doing that. Let's start thermodynamics on Wednesday, and then I can tell you about how they were made. There's about enough time today. Now, we quit when? Straight up and down? Let me tell you about an entirely different subject that you need to know about. It's one of my pet peeve subjects, so to speak. Not about you, about a company. I want to talk to you about Coca-Cola. And give you the history of the thing and see if you don't think as I do when I get through that it falls in the category of the things that Joseph Smith talked about in the Word of Wisdom, where he said evil and designing man in the latter day will get if you don't watch out. As a friend of mine, a Jewish friend, I had more than one Jewish friend, at least three at the General Electric Company. But there's one Jewish friend that was fairly high up in the research lab. He used to get so mad at the Coca-Cola Company. Big companies trade directors. For example, the Schick Razor man will be maybe the president of Schick Razor. He'll be on the board of directors of General Electric Company. And big wheels make a lot of dough this way because they'll get maybe a $10,000 fee for meeting four meetings a year. And they trade off, so you get to be a director of about 12 different companies and get $10,000 for four meetings a year at each company. And at the same time, you're the president of another company getting $100,000 a year. Well, the president of the Coca-Cola Company was on the board of directors of General Electric Company. That guy saw to it that there's a Coca-Cola machine in every nook and cranny, of the General Electric Company. Just everywhere there was a Coke machine. So he not only got paid by GE, he was using it as an end to do this. And this Jewish friend of mine used to get so mad about that, because he figured like I do, because he knew the history of Coca-Cola and what it is. Well, now, Coca-Cola's origins go back to about 1890, somewhere along in there. This was a period in the history of the United States when there was just no end of patent medicines. Everything you can imagine. Things to maybe make the baby quit crying, things to cure your corns and bunions and your pneumonia and your diphtheria and everything else. And all the medicines were rolled up into one, just one thing, you know, would cure everything from baldness to bunions. Top of your head to the soles of your feet. Most of these patent medicines contained hard drugs, something like morphine, for example. And the babies were awfully quiet in those days because people were ignorant and didn't know these things. And so the baby would take the morphine, and sure, he'd be quiet. He'd quit bawling. And the women used to take Lydia Pinkham's vegetable something or other compound. And they used to have pink pills for pale people. Just no end of pills. And most of them contained hard drugs, cocaine, codeine, morphine. The whole spectrum of hard drugs was in all these patent medicine things. And in addition to that, they were all 50% alcohol in addition in the main. Well, now, there started to be a lot of rumblings in the United States that something ought to be done about this. And the formation of an agency that came to be known as the Food and Drug Administration. Foundations were being laid back in those days, and guys would try and get it through Congress and not get it through. But it was all in the process of, you know, you could see that eventually it was going to get through. There's going to be a law passed to establish this Food and Drug Administration to try and take care and get rid of such things like that. Well, one smart Southern gentleman, seeing the handwriting on the wall and figuring that they would probably slap the thing on medicines first and not food, decided to come up with a so-called soft drink. And that soft drink was Coca-Cola. And it contained cocaine. But now you see, it was not a medicine. It was a soft drink. Now, it got its name, Coke, from cocaine. And that's what you call a hard drug to this very day. And most people don't make the connection. Coca-Cola used coca berries, which had cocaine. The leaves of coca berries, which had cocaine in them. And so people start drinking Coke, and they really loved it. Back in those days, it also contained alcohol. Well, now, when the law went through the Congress, the guy lost out because they covered food and drug. And Coca-Cola became subject to the law that you couldn't have these hard drugs in these things. Well, the drink was established. And the guys were raking in the money because, of course, it was habit forming. Well, what did they do? They cast about, how can we beat the Food and Drug Administration and introduce some hooker in there, you know, the strongest hooker that the Drug Administration will allow us to get by with. Well, now as they looked around, they discovered that a German firm who made a product called Kaffee Hag Coffee, which was decaffeinated, had been saving the extract of caffeine, not knowing what they would ever do with it, but they extracted with an organic solvent caffeine from the coffee, purified it, white crystalline solid, and were saving it. Now, it was used in medicine somewhat, but they had a lot of this on hand from extracting the caffeine from coffee. And this Southern gentleman who'd started this Coca-Cola company got the idea of putting that byproduct in his Coca-Cola in place of the cocaine. So it was the first soft drink that had caffeine in it. Now, as time went on, that particular drink became so popular that the Kathy Hag coffee byproduct could not supply the caffeine that was required for the drink. So chemists are pretty smart fellows, and some chemists at the Monsanto Chemical Company, seeing the great need for this product, decided to see if they could synthesize from various products available, coal tar products and petroleum products and other basic starting materials for many chemical compounds, succeeded in using coal tar derivatives and manufacturing caffeine synthetically. And they make it by the thousands of tons yearly ever since they were able to start doing that back in the late 1930s. Well, other soft drink people and other people, seeing the great success of the Coca-Cola company, hooking people all over the world on the lift you get from caffeine, decided to add caffeine to the drink and such things. Well, other cola companies came in, you know, Royal Crown, Dr. Pepper, and all the rest of them. Well, Dr. Pepper isn't billed as a cola, but people who like it because it contains caffeine. Now, for some reason, the people who control that company have had enough power through the years to avoid putting on that thing what it contains. It's never been listed that caffeine was in the stuff. Until recent years, there are some restrictive laws in some places in some states. But Coca-Cola escapes, in the main, from having to put that this contains caffeine on the cap or on the bottle. But the laws have been changed so that at this point, if you come out with a new drink that contains caffeine, the Food and Drug Administration does require that you put on that label that it does contain caffeine. Now, Coca-Cola is pretty tricky. They came out with Tab as a new drink, and they advertise it in the improvement era. And one day, my wife started drinking Tab and really started like it. And one day I looked, and in the finest print, you could hardly read on the cap, it said the caffeine was one of the ingredients. So I got some of her older bottles and they didn't have that on. So they had switched, see? They'd advertised it to people and it was a non-caffeine drink, I presume.
They did.
And then they switched and started to add the caffeine to it, and then they had to put it on. Well, now, the bishop isn't going to ask you when you go for a temple recommend or an interview if you drink Coca-Cola, and if you said yes, he wouldn't deny you your temple recommend. However, he would if you said you drank coffee. To a chemist, it doesn't make any difference, but we're not running the church, and I'm not criticizing any church leaders for not taking a stand on that. But I'm just giving you Tracy Hall's personal view that with that bad history of Coca-Cola, which fits in with exactly what the Word of Wisdom says to me about what guys are going to be doing in the latter day, I wouldn't drink the stuff for any reason, just for that principle in itself, you see, and knowing the history of how it started and how deliberate it was and has been and still is, to keep you drinking it by having you hooked on it. Now, caffeine is not a powerful hooker like codeine or cocaine or morphine, but still, it hooks people. Another reason they drink it. They'll tell you, oh, I drink it for its flavor. But they don't know they're drinking it for its caffeine content, in my opinion. I had a boss who used to say, I can quit smoking any time. But I get so much pleasure. That's all he gets. He just gets pleasure out of smoking, so he's not going to quit. He used to say that so straight-faced and so seriously, I just couldn't watching him, I just couldn't help but laugh inside because I knew he was hooked on it. He couldn't have quit if he'd have wanted to. Now, what is bad about caffeine? Well, a lot of things have been written medically about caffeine. I think I mentioned to you that in order to make the caffeine perform better in your system, that Coca-Cola puts in a lot of phosphoric acid in the drink also, which increases the effectiveness of the caffeine in your system. Better off drinking coffee. Just from the standpoint of the caffeine. Well, there are a lot of things that caffeine does. The most serious charge that has not surfaced in the public literature yet is the fact that caffeine does break up chromosomes. And the first scientific article that I am aware of concerning damage that that has probably caused in the United States is due to a lady whose name I've forgotten who worked at the National Institutes of Health, and she had a paper in 1940 correlating coffee drinking in the United States as probably being the underlying factor in the large number of birth defects in this country, which are way above normal compared to the rest of the world. Birth defects in the United States, in a civilized country that eats good food and has all that it needs, you know, run higher than in other countries of the world, such as Japan or Europe and whatnot. And she attributed it to the heavy drinking of cola drinks and coffee, which in the United States far exceeds what occurs in any other part of the world. Well, a caffeine definitely is destructive to the heart of life. The chromosomal material is damaged by the presence of caffeine. Very readily demonstrated in cell cultures and statistically demonstrated just as tobacco was statistically demonstrated to produce cancer in populations of animals such as rats and whatnot, and statistically demonstrated as far as birthday defects are concerned. That will probably surface someday. All this was known for tobacco at least 25 years. It was pretty solid evidence before the public became aroused and reporters and whatnot become active enough to dare get it out in public. The Surgeon General, you know, had to be a very brave man to finally come out and make flat statements that tobacco was injurious to your health. There are other problems with caffeine. It's a very powerful reducing agent. Chemically, that's what it is. It's a very powerful reducing agent. Now, our body uses both reducing and oxidizing agents, but they're mild. They're mild agents. Caffeine is a powerful one, and just as a chemist, you'd say, well, that wouldn't be too smart to take such a powerful reducing agent into your system. It couldn't help but raise a little havoc here and there. It seems to have a special affinity for chromosomal material, which is at the very heart of life, and for that reason it's kind of a bad substance. Well, okay, I've had my say about Coca-Cola and caffeine. You got any questions?
What's a reducing agent?
Reducing agent is a substance that donates electrons. See, chemical reaction, a strong oxidizing agent is struggling for an electron, and a strong reducing agent is trying to push one on. And all chemical reactions are involved with the transfer of electrons. But in biological systems, that's a mild kind of a thing as a rule. It's a very subtle, well-controlled thing. And It's just not good to take strong oxidizing agents or strong reducing agents into your system that are beyond what you would normally find in foods. Okay.
Who is this other gentleman?
I don't know his name. I've seen it, but I don't remember it. What I've given you is, in the main, been written up in chemical journals in past years.
How does caffeine jack up your metabolism?
I don't know. Caffeine affects your heart, respiration. It alters physiological processes. Caffeine combined with aspirin is what is in the Excedrin, and any powerful pain reliever is a combination. They give you caffeine and they give you aspirin. Those are the main things they put together. Anacin was the first non-prescription medicine that contained them both. Anacin was a combination of aspirin with caffeine. When you're not used to caffeine, it can be kind of hard on you. Sometimes doctors give you pills and they don't tell you what's in the pills. I remember going to a doc once for something, and what he in essence had given me was Anacin. And I could not sleep at night. He had me taking them for a period of days. I just could not sleep. And my heart seemed to be beating up in my ears all the time. And finally, I complained to the doctor, what did you give me that was doing? Oh, nothing that hurt you, just a little caffeine. I said, well, I never drink coffee or stuff like that. And this has really been bothering me. Oh, yeah, it could if you're not a coffee drinker. So you may have been giving me quite a dose, and my system not being used to it at all, it was really getting to me.
Well, I went to the dentist one time, and he had given me Novocaine for a shot. Gave me a big old, for a feeling, big old shot, went away for 10 minutes to let it take effect, came back, it wasn't numb at all. And we started drilling, and I was just screaming. And I said, this is a really good thing. And she said, yes, he gave me another shot. Went away for about 10 minutes, came back. He started doing it again, and I felt it, and I was just, it was just awful. So he gave me another shot. Finally, he asked me, I think he asked me if I had drank coffee or did something like that. And I said, no, I don't. He said, well, it's really weird. People whose systems aren't accustomed to any kind of stimulants or painkillers or anything like that, it affects them differently. Some people it just anything will do them, and then other people, if you're not accustomed to anything like that, it just doesn't.
Your system got rid of it in a hurry.
I guess, I don't know what it was, but it's really funny that he was just shaking his head. And it does weird things.
I dislike the shots immensely. I'd rather have them work on my raw tooth than. But it's sure hard to get them to do it. They go faster, and they're more of a butcher. That's another reason for not letting them deaden it. They're more careful. But boy, the dentist, they want to shoot you so you don't know what's going on.